Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Slate Money is brought to you by TaxAct. File simple federal and state returns for free by visiting taxact.com/slate. TaxAct will guide you through every step of the process using your computer, tablet, or phone, and get you the maximum refund guaranteed. That's taxact.com/slate. And by Texture, the mobile app that lets you tap directly into the world's most popular magazines anywhere using your phone or tablet. Dive deeper into Vogue, People, Esquire, Time, and hundreds more with interactive content for a richer reading experience. Right now, try Texture for free at texture.com/money. That's texture.com/money. And by MileIQ. If you're one of the 60 million Americans who drive for work, then you know that your miles are your dollars. Every mile you don't log is money that you're losing. MileIQ is the only mileage tracker app that detects, logs, and calculates your miles for you, ensuring that every mile is accounted for and no dollars lost. Try MileIQ for free today by texting Slate Money to 31996. That's Slate Money to 31996.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, people. Happy New Year. It is 2016, and it's going to be an amazing year, isn't it, Kathy?
It is.
It can only get better.
Fantastic.
From here on in.
Yep.
We have already been talking about our amazing New Year's resolution edition of Slate Money, which, if all goes according to plan, is going to happen next week.
Woo!
Woo! But this is the Hogmanay edition of Slate Money. This is the...
I have no idea what that word means.
Yeah, they just made that up.
You, neither of you know what Hogmanay is?
No.
I assume it sounds like some sort of Scottish delicacy.
It's fried.
You're not far off, in a way. Hogmanay is the biggest night of the year in Scotland.
Oh, wow, I got close.
And it's the time when all Scots go out and drink even more than they normally do.
No true Scots stay sober on Hogmanay.
Did you guys see the hangover search result, like hangover cure graph for like every day of the year for the Google searches?
No, I haven't.
It's like an absolute spike on January 1st.
Oh, really?
I feel sorry for everyone listening to this.
But the interesting thing is that about 90% of those searches come from Scotland. Hogmanay is what the Scots call New Year's Eve. And it is, if you've never had New Year's Eve, if you've never spent New Year's Eve in Scotland, I can highly recommend it. It is a lot of fun. It gets dark very early. You start drinking even before then. And it's...
Did you go to college in Scotland?
I did. I went to Glasgow University.
That's right.
So this is the Hogmanay edition. We are going to be welcoming in the new year without booze. Our lovely producer, Zach Dinerstein, is smiling here because he knows that it's going to be a happy edit for him compared to Ink Uncensored, which was very boozy and which I guest starred on this week.
I can only imagine.
There was a lot of sparkling wine drunk over the course of that. So apologies to anyone who wanted us to get shit-faced on this podcast. But yeah, we are going to talk about... what are we going to talk about this week? Oh, wait, hang on a sec. I should introduce Kathy O'Neill.
Oh, hi.
Hi, the blogger at mathbabe.org in general, awesome person. I should introduce Jordan Weissman. Hi, Jordan.
Hello.
The Moneybox columnist who's...
I don't know what that
also
accent
good
was.
At funny voices. I'm not sure what that was.
What's that doing?
Kathy is going to talk about derivatives trading because, and we're going to make it interesting. Don't go away. Jordan is going to talk about Hogmanay. Why not? And I am going to talk about Warren Buffett because you can never get enough Warren Buffett. Let's start with eeny, meeny, miny, Jordan.
Okay. So the internet was really bored this week, like really deeply, deeply bored.
It was a slow news week.
It's a slow news week. There are like three people in everyone's office. You know what I'm talking about. So when news broke that Olive Garden was charging $400 a pop for its New Year's Eve party, everyone kind of went nuts. Just
yeah, and this idea of breaking news, Olive Garden, there's only one Olive Garden on the planet which does this.
Yes,
it's the Olive Garden
Square,
in Times Square, yeah, which is the biggest Olive Garden in the world. And which does this every year. This is not exactly news.
Yes, but the New York Post decided to report on it. And well, basically what the New York Post did was it went and just asked all the Times Square restaurants how much they were going to charge for the evening. Bubba Gump shrimp was $799. And we're going to come back to Bubba Gump in a second.
Bubba Gump shrimp, by the way, is a restaurant which is named after a fictional company in Forrest Gump.
Yes.
The
yes,
movie.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Fried shrimp, scampi shrimp, you know, black
Wait,
and
when
shrimp.
When did Forrest Gump come out? I want to say it's like early 80s.
94.
Oh,
yeah.
Early 90s.
Yeah.
I'm so way off.
Yeah.
I just feel like it has spawned a restaurant. Can we stop talking
about that movie? I mean, why? Why?
Is this a chain or is there only one of
no,
them?
No, it's a chain.
It's a chain.
Yeah, it's a chain.
I think you have to be. Isn't there some rule that you have to be a chain restaurant if you're in Times Square?
I think those are the only ones that are going to be able to do enough business probably to, or be able to even make like the investment up front to do that. Although, you know, that's not totally true because Guy Fieri has a restaurant in Times Square.
It closed.
It closed. No, they're offering a New Year's Eve.
It was too good.
It closed? They were offering a New Year's Eve party last I looked.
Welcome to Flavortown, that one?
Yeah.
I thought that one closed.
We'll have to fact check this later.
We don't fact check, so
I think Ruby Tuesdays had a $1,700 dinner for two and a VIP booth. You get the idea. This is what they're charging. And so I took a look in particular at Bubba Gump Shrimp's pricing model. And my opinion is actually that they undercharged everyone. But Felix, I want to start with you. As the resident food snob, and Kathy, you too a little bit, are you appalled by this or do you see a sense in people paying $400 to $1,600 for this?
The first thing I will say is that this is a complete no-brainer. Given the choice between spending New Year's Eve in Times Square with a million other people with nothing to eat, nothing to drink, nowhere to sit, nowhere to pee. There are people who literally turn up to Times Square wearing adult diapers because there's nowhere to pee. Given the choice between that, which just seems like the ninth circle of hell, and spending $400 to have a chair and a toilet and an open bar, like, you know, it would take me a fraction of a second to, you know, sign up for Olive Garden or anywhere where there was, you know, somewhere to sit down and booze. So it really depends on what your perspective is. From the perspective of someone like me who just can't imagine ever wanting to go to Times Square on New Year's Eve, it makes no sense. Why would you ever want to, you know, spending $1,700 at Bubba Gump Shrimp doesn't make any sense either. But it makes more sense than the million people who are in New Year's Eve. I mean, in Times Square.
Okay, well, look, I have a different perspective. But it ends up being pretty close. So the first thing I thought about is like, well, what is this apple dropping or whatever, the ball dropping? Is this a public event? In which case, like, if it was like a firecrackers event, like, then it would offend me that only rich people, you know, that you could pay your way into a good spot, into a sort of elite spot, because I'm thinking, oh, it's a public, it should be publicly accessible. I looked into the history, though, a little bit of this event.
Okay.
And it's never been a public event.
Well, in fact, Times Square is a public space. Anyone can turn up.
But I guess what I mean to say is it's never been a non-commercial event. It is a commercial event. It got started by the guy who ran the New York Times way back when in 1907. And I've taken a quote from the webpage of this event that happens every year since 1907, except in 1942 and 1943. On the very first year, waiters in the fabled, quote, lobster palaces, unquote, and other deluxe eateries in hotels surrounding Times Square were supplied with battery-powered top hats emblazoned with the numbers 1908, fashioned on tiny light bulbs. At the stroke of midnight, they all flipped their lids, and the year on their foreheads lit up in conjunction with the numbers 1908 on the parapet of the Times Tower.
So not only is this an old tradition,
yes,
it's been this tacky for its entire history.
It's like it's actually a completely consistent arc. And so for that reason, I'm just like, yeah, this is about commercialism. This is about selling ridiculous food
I don't think anyone is paying for the food.
No, yeah. no one's paying for the food.
We can agree
yeah,
on
they're
that.
They're paying for the location. Although some of the funny thing is some of the restaurants actually can't really see the ball drop, and those are the ones that are charging less. It's interesting to see how there is price sensitivity here. These aren't all just like, it's clear they're not catering just to rich people because there are different levels at which you can pay. You know, everything from like a $200, $300 ticket to the $1,600 table for two. I want to make my argument quickly about why Bubba Gump is actually undercharging. I think it's very clear that they are leaving money on the table. And so they're charging about $800 a head. However, if you look, they sold out. And I checked with the company, and they actually sold out in 5 days. So already, when you see something selling out, that's usually a sign that it's underpriced because, you know, too many people, there's more demand.
Can you get, like, Bubba Gump reservations on StubHub? Is there a secondary market in
there? there might be. I mean, there are tickets, but I should have looked at that. But here's the thing. So I went and checked a little further. It turns out they award their tickets by lottery. You have to sign up months ahead of time, and then they give, if you win the lottery, you get your tickets, and then you pay. Which the obvious takeaway there is that demand way outstrips the set supply.
Which is Jordan's way of saying that rather than have even a veneer of democracy here, this really should just be for rich people.
This should be an auction. Yeah, I mean, Bubba Gump really should be.
This should just reward the people with the most money to burn.
I think that's what Jordan said.
Yeah, that is what,
direct
what
quote.
Well, what I am saying that they are. Yeah, that's basically. Actually, if I could swap that, I would.
I actually just. Business idea. I'm going to just carry a porta potty down to Times Square and charge like $50 for each person who wants to use it.
Oh man, there might be some licensing or.
I need to ask because you guys are the Americans.
Yeah,
and this is where I get to pull my foreigner card.
Yeah,
can someone explain to me? Like, I perfectly understand the whole if you're going to Times Square, you would like to be able to sit down. Can you explain to me the overwhelming majority of the 99% of people in Times Square who are just standing there freezing and for hours and hours? They can be like there for 8 or 9 hours. You have to get there super early.
Yeah, you do.
Can someone explain this?
No.
Do you have to get there early, you have to stay inside a pen. They call it them pens. Yeah. And then you have to wear.
If chickens were treated like this, that would be considered like inhumane and no one would want to eat them.
That's not true, Felix. Chickens are treated like this.
You know, I've had the urge to do it. So I've never done it, but I have had the urge to do it. I think I would never do it with kids. I would never do it with elderly people. I would only do it with people who are just like, we're going to see if we can drink this entire bottle of whiskey.
Which you're not allowed to bring in.
No, but I mean, people sneak it
obviously
in.
You have to bring whiskey.
Yeah, people people sneak stuff in. People get drunk beforehand. All of that then will wear off after 8 hours. You know, there's something to be said for just being there, I think. Some people just really like to be at the center of things, and they think of Times Square as, like, the center of New Year's celebration.
And I also want to add that, like, it has nothing to do with actually watching the ball drop. I mean, it can't. Like, these restaurants aren't giving them good views. It's about being in Times
Square. Well, Bubba Gum Shrimp is. Bubba Gum Shrimp has, like, a direct view. That's why it can charge so much.
Okay, whatever.
Yeah, that's, again, this is why I think they should be auctioning
to the highest bidder. It's about being there. It's about being part of it's literally a million people.
Yeah.
A million people every year.
I can tell you, as someone, I worked at Reuters for 5 years, and Reuters is right next to the ball.
Like, yeah.
You do not get a better view of the
ball.
I have
a friend who stayed there for New Year's 1 year just
Reuters.
To watch it.
And there was this annual email which would go out saying, well, if you want to come in and, like, work that night, you know, you have to be in by this time and you can't leave until that time. And all of us would look at each other and go, why on earth would we want to do that? But apparently people pay a fortune for being able to do that.
Oh, no, if Reuters...
Reuters was leaving money on the table as well.
Actually, to be entirely honest, if Reuters is having any financial troubles these days, I haven't checked in a while, this might be a revenue stream. Like, they might really want to check into it. They make, you know, at least $100 a ticket just for the... Anyway.
Okay, so, Kathy.
Yes.
In a second...
Yeah.
You are going to talk to us about derivatives.
I will.
But
I'm going to make it sexy, too.
You talk to us about derivatives. I'm going to tell you about our sponsor, which is TaxAct. You've made all of the money. I hate to break this to you, but all of the money that you are going to make in 2015 has now been made. It is done. Your job now is to tell the government how much you made in 2015. And with TaxAct.com, that's how you do it. You get easy, fast, affordable tax filing at your fingertips. You get everything you need to file your taxes. If your deal is getting the best deal, go to taxact.com/slate and get your simple federal and state returns for free. TaxAct.com hedgefund.com/slate. So, you used to work at a hedge fund.
I did.
And the hedge fund traded derivatives and presumably made money doing that.
Yeah, I guess so.
But it's also possible, it turns out, to lose a lot of money trading derivatives.
Yes, it is. You know, I'm gonna get a little wonky here, but it's gonna be
fun. We like that.
Okay.
On this show. You're allowed to. That's why we have you on.
Oh, really? Yeah. I thought it was for my body.
That's next week.
That's the second.
That's next week. Okay.
That's next week.
So look, I was in the futures trading group, but what I'm interested in talking about today is options, because there was a really interesting article written by...
Do our listeners need to understand the difference? Is it important?
It's important because there's a really interesting story around the Black-Scholes formula that I want to tell.
Okay.
Well, I find it interesting. We'll see what the...
I'm excited think. For it.
So Black-Scholes, there's actually two people. There's Fisher Black... And Merton Scholes?
Myron Scholes. Merton, but he's like the third one.
Yeah, let's just ignore that guy. In fact, I'm going to ignore the first two guys from now on, because I'm going to say the one thing they did, and this is a while ago, I want to say late 70s or early 80s, is they figured out how to price an option. And the way they did it was they created a synthetic portfolio of a bond and some stock. And let me just explain that. First of all, let's talk about what an option is. I think for the sake of this discussion, an option is just sort of like a seller of last resort. Like if you own a bunch of things and you want to be able to sell them, say it's like crude oil or corn, and you want to make sure that you can sell it at some price that's not too, too low, then you buy an option that gives you the right to sell it at the sort of lowest, a low price. So it's not going to go below that price. Well, options existed for a long, long time, but people didn't know exactly how much to charge for them. Or how much to pay for them. And these guys came along and said, you know what, we can create a synthetic version of this, which is to say something that pays off the same amount of money in the same situations. So it's almost exactly like the same thing, except it's not quite the same thing because it's made up of bonds and stocks instead.
Interesting.
So what's good about that, it doesn't sound like they've done much, right? Because they've just replicated the same kind of contract with using two different things instead of one thing. The great news was that they knew how much those two things, those two components, cost. And so they could therefore back out how much the original thing should cost.
Now, I just want to jump in here and say that Nassim Taleb has done a bunch of work at looking at how much options cost before Black-Scholes came along. And what you said is that no one knew how much to charge for them. It turns out that if you look at how much options cost after Black-Scholes, they cost generally a little bit more than the Black-Scholes formula would suggest on average. And if you look at how much they cost before Black-Scholes came out, they cost generally a little bit more than the Black-Scholes formula would suggest on average. Basically, the Black-Scholes formula gave people a scientific benchmark they could compute things off of, but it didn't actually change the pricing at all.
Well, here's what's interesting, Felix, and thanks for bringing that up. Like, people believed in the Black-Scholes formula like it was a dictum from a god, and it which is a bad thing. It because one of the reasons is it was wrong. It assumed something which would turn out to be completely wrong, namely that the volatility of the market is going to stay fixed at a certain thing, at a certain volatility.
And it also assumed continuous markets and
yes,
a whole bunch of stuff.
And it assumed all sorts of things. Once you had this formula, in other words, what happened was once traders had this formula in their pocket, they were just like, I know what I'm doing. And it created this false sense of security, an illusion of control, if you will.
And so that brings us back to the article that you wanted to talk about, which was very cool. But I feel like you should intro it because this is such your wheelhouse. Well, I'm going to butcher it if I try to. So.
Okay, well, it really was an article written by this guy named Bob Henderson, who made a huge amount of money by selling an option to Mexico to basically assure the lower bound of price for something called Maya crude. It's a kind of oil, but it's not the standard type of oil.
Yeah, so basically, well, I do know enough about the oil market to talk about this, but
yeah.
So Mexico pumps a lot of really dirty, heavy crude oil out of its waters, and it takes a lot of processing. And so it's not quite the same thing as the crude that we pump up in the United States. And for, you know, if Mexico wanted in the past to basically ensure the price it would get on its oil, it used to have to use derivatives based on U.S. oil. American oil. And frankly, oftentimes they kind of tracked each other, but the markets weren't quite the same. And so it was interesting from an oil markets perspective. What Scott Bob Henderson did was he said, you, Mexico, I'm going to create essentially an insurance policy, an option that guarantees you the ability to sell your Maya crude at a certain price. And it's going to be based on Maya crude. It's not going to be based on U.S. oil.
Right. And so what Bob Henderson did was he said, I'm going to build you the option you want for a certain price, and I will take on the risk of creating the synthetic portfolio on my behalf, on my side. And that's a lot of risk he took on. And one thing that happened was, you know, we talked about it as a bond and some kind of underlying stock. Well, in this case, the underlying was a different kind of oil, which was called fuel oil. And the problem was that the option he sold to Mexico was so huge, and he had to buy so much fuel oil. And by the way, I should have mentioned that when you do this synthetic portfolio, you have to act on it every day. You have to sort of re-up the portfolio to make sure it's following the option. And he ended up having to sell and sell and sell and sell fuel oil at a huge loss.
Because he'd written this option, he needed to do this thing called delta hedging, which we're not going to be that wonky.
No,
but
we're not.
The effect is that every day, according to what happens in the market, you have to either buy or sell. And if the market's going down, every day you need to sell a bit more. And the problem was that the size of the option that he'd written was so huge, that the amount of fuel oil he had to sell every day was so huge, that he was the one huge seller in the market.
Right.
And he was driving the price down just by dint of selling all of this fuel oil, and it became this vicious cycle.
Yes, he was moving the market in fuel oil, which actually lowered the price more, and then he had to sell more. So this is a great, going back to the Black-Scholes formula, this is a great example. Black-Scholes did not assume that your actions would change the market price. It assumed that you were acting in small enough ways so that nothing like that happened. And so yet another mistake with Black-Scholes. The funny thing about the story, of course, is that he renegotiated. He knew what was happening. He renegotiated with Mexico, and he ended up making a shit ton of money. And Mexico ended up happy as well. And ultimately, it was kind of a huge humble brag, the whole article. But it was also interesting looking into the Black-Scholes
formulas. This is one of the genius things about derivatives traders, is people think that you sell an option and then you either make money on selling that option or lose money on selling that option. But in fact, what these people are is salespeople. He sold this massive deal to Mexico. And as his boss told him, you know, when he got his massive bonus at the end of the year, I'm giving you this massive bonus because you sold this massive deal to Mexico. And all of the work you wound up doing and all of the money you lost and then made back is really neither here nor there. I'm giving you this bonus for selling the deal to Mexico. And in fact, what he did was he sold two deals to Mexico. He sold a big deal to Mexico. And then what happened is that the price of Maya crude went down a lot. Mexico had a huge mark-to-market gain on the option that it had bought. So what he did is he went back to Mexico and said, I'm going to allow you to re-up this deal and lock in a lot of that gain. And Mexico said, that sounds good. We just make $3 billion. And Bob Henderson said, that sounds good to me, because if you didn't do that, I would lose $200 million a month for the foreseeable future and I would lose my job. And he also then, this is the crazy bit, took this massive prop bet on fuel oil, basically. He bet that it was going to continue to fall, which it did. And then he covered that bet, more or less timed the market perfectly, covered it when it was at the bottom, started buying a bunch of fuel oil, then it went up, and he made a fortune on fuel oil. And so never mind the whole sort of Black-Scholes synthetic, like trying to delta hedge and all of that kind of stuff. He more or less gave up on that and just prop bet the whole oil market and made a fortune.
So that's the thing. So one thing we left out at the beginning of this, it's sort of important, is he sold this option to Mexico right before the financial crisis. He basically insured 2/3 of Mexico's entire 2009 oil production, which is just insane. You insured 2/3 of one of the world's largest oil producers.
And in general,
exports.
Just to be clear about this, You want to be a buyer of options when volatility is low and a seller of options when volatility is high. That's basically how you make money in options. What he did is he sold the option to Mexico when volatility was low, and that's exactly the position you don't want to be in.
By the way, it was enough to fill more than 100 super tankers with oil.
Yeah.
That's how much oil we're talking
about.
I mean,
there was nothing he could... I mean, he was up Schitt's Creek without a paddle,
but he found a paddle. That
well, he
was the
found one.
Thing.
But so this is the point.
he
kind of
a couple of
this is the point he kind of makes in our article, is that all of his mathematical models basically failed him And because he had done all this stress testing, he had done all these tests to see what the worst case scenario was, because he didn't see the Great Recession coming and he didn't see the actual worst case scenario for the oil market. So the models were useless because the assumptions were bad. And that's where he comes back to this idea of the illusion of control, is that people tend to think they have more ability to influence what are actually random events than they really do.
Well, not even influence, but they rarely imagine that things are going to get worse than they have been in the past.
Especially if they have mathematical models.
Which are based on the past. So, you know, one of my pet animals, you know, in my menagerie of financial instruments is this thing called the Gaussian copula function, which was more or less the single most destructive piece of mathematics ever invented. And this was basically something which looked at credit derivative prices on mortgage-backed securities over the period of about 2 or 3 years that these things existed. And based on the volatility of this incredibly benign period that they were trading, said, well, they can never go too bad. And then people started writing all of these crazy instruments based on the idea that they never really move very much. But of course, they only never really moved very much over 2 years between 2004 and 2006.
It's the fighting the last war thing. It was interesting to me because a lot of what he was saying in this article actually reminded me of our conversation with Greg Ipp. This article in Nautilus talks about the Fed stress tests now. Every year, the Federal Reserve requires banks to undergo a stress test, which sees, will they essentially survive if the worst happens? But their idea of the worst is essentially a replication of the Great Recession. That's there. They look at if unemployment spikes and GDP goes down by X amount. What they don't look up, and this is a point in the article, is say the euro cracks up. Something truly disastrous and unforeseen takes place. Hyperinflation, something along those lines. And so, again, like, you know, Greg told us before, there's a degree to which when regulators try to fix things and make them safer, they're fighting the last war. It seems like there's a little bit of that going on with the Fed and their attempts to control and prevent another disaster or suffer from some of the same flaws. I thought that was notable.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be a purely mathematical process to fool us. There was an incredible Atlantic article on the VW scandal, written by Jerry Usim. And he talked about like the normalization of deviance, where you have these scripts that you go by, especially if you're the CEO of a large company or up there. And, you know, things get more and more out of whack, but you're just following your scripts. It's just similar to be like following the formula.
Normalization
just believe in it.
Deviance is something you see all over the place. I literally see it every day. I ride my city bike around New York City every day, and I ride bicycles in other cities around the world as well. If you ride a bike around London or around Copenhagen or around New York, you see massive differences in basically how law-abiding cyclists are. And in New York, cyclists are happy to do this horrible thing called salmoning, where you run the wrong way down the street, or they run through red lights, or they ride on sidewalks, and they do all of these things they're not allowed to do, mainly because everyone else seems to be doing it, and it seems normal. And all of these are behaviors which you would never see in, say, Cambridge, you know. And so it's localized often within certain communities.
Yeah.
But once a bunch of people start doing things, you get much, much more deviant behavior and it becomes normalized.
The last thing I'll say is that both these articles talk about the role of stress inside that that localized culture, and how every human being always thinks the future is going to be good. But stressed out human beings who are under pressure from their bosses are even particularly bad about this. They will do anything in the currently to avoid future problems. They just don't believe future problems will happen. And so you see that with the VW thing. You see that with this kind of derivatives trading. It's all over the place.
Okay. So if you want to learn more about the Gaussian copula function, read my article in Wired Magazine. This is where I segue seamlessly into the ad for Texture, who is a sponsor of Slate Money this year, or this week at least. We hope all year, because we love Texture, because they're a great company, and they're basically Spotify for magazines, and you can read Wired, you can read The New Yorker, you can read, you know, basically any magazine you want. It starts with Adweek and All Recipes and Allure, and it goes all the way through to Women's Health, Wood Magazine, Working Mother, and Yoga Journal. And there are over 100 different magazines, including all of your favorite magazines. Literally, you want to look at this list because it has all of them. It's one subscription, and you just pay that one subscription, and then it's all available on your tablet. It's kind of awesome. Or your phone. You can read any magazine you want, any article from any magazine, going back years. And yeah, I can recommend it. And you can save it for offline reading if you're on a plane or the subway or whatever. Anything you want to do, you can do. So it's called Texture. If you have ever found yourself at, say, an airport newsstand, you think, I should stock up on magazines. A month subscription to Texture costs less than, like, just buying three magazines at the airport newsstand, but you get hundreds of them, and they're always available to you. They have a curated collections list. It's easy to use. And guess what?
What?
There's a free trial.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. So you go to texture.com/slatemoney. So you get it for free right now by going to texture.com/slatemoney and try it out. And if you don't like it, you don't pay anything. It's awesome.
Great.
Next up is Warren Buffett. Now, we've talked about the skeevy side of Warren Buffett's empire before. Okay, so back in 2015, this pair of reporters, Mike Baker and Daniel Wagner, who were at the Seattle Times and the Center for Public Integrity, wrote a story about how Clayton Homes, which is a subsidiary of Berkshire Hathaway, was a predatory lender. This is Warren Buffett's mobile home subsidiary, basically. Now, Mike Baker and Daniel Wagner have come back with another article, but now it's Seattle Times and BuzzFeed, because obviously BuzzFeed is better at these things than the Center for Public Integrity.
They're not bad at it.
They're very good.
I was so in love with this article.
And what it does is it's the same story about predatory lending by Clayton Homes and the mortgage lenders that Berkshire Hathaway owns, but they've added this just particularly evil racial overlay to the whole thing. Yeah. And what they're showing is that a lot of the victims are Native Americans or African Americans, and these people, or, you know, these are people, sometimes Hispanic Americans, who don't speak English and who have very friendly Spanish-speaking salespeople, but then get presented with a whole bunch of English language jargon documents which they can't read and don't understand. They're just told to sign on the dotted line. So Kathy, you loved this article.
It was just so good. And, you know, one of the things I loved about it is they had this, I don't know if you noticed, a link to their methodology. Just it warms the cockles of my heart.
BuzzFeed is very good in its investigations, like the H-2 visa investigation especially, of having a lot of primary documents there so you can really see exactly what they're talking about.
So, and I also just want to make a plug for a certain civil rights regulation law that they're using here. This sounds, I know how sexy this is, but it really is. It's amazing. It's called the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act. And what it does, because these are prefabricated homes, whenever you take a loan out to buy one, it's considered a mortgage loan. And so it falls under this act, which basically means you have to collect race information about the borrower. The reason is because historically, lenders would practice redlining, which would mean they would avoid giving certain people loans. So this act was just to be able to keep track of whether this redlining was happening. Now, what these guys did in this article was they tracked not redlining, but what they called reverse redlining. And that is that you charge minorities more money than you would charge white person.
Redlining is where you refuse to lend to minorities. Reverse redlining is where you target minorities because they're the most profitable segment.
So they had this. They had this one line that said Vanderbilt's a lender for that works for what's it called? I'm sorry,
Berkshire Hathaway.
Warren Buffett.
Okay,
it's part of this galaxy of companies.
Yeah. So Vanderbilt typically charged black people who made over $75,000 a year slightly more than white people who make only $35,000.
Okay, now this is where I'm going to come in and do a tiny bit of in defense of Warren Buffett.
Okay, please.
Because income is not really much of a factor in the way that these loans are underwritten. And if you look at things which are factors, like credit scores, I think what happens is that these differences basically go away. It is well known that black people earning $75,000 a year have roughly the same credit as white people earning, you know, $35,000 a year. Or, you know, they have worse credit, they have less wealth. All of these things are racist. You know, I mean, it's bad that because of the structural racism in the United States, that for any given income group, certain minorities and African Americans in particular are much, much worse off financially. But given that, it does kind of stand to reason that they are going to wind up paying more for their mortgages.
My point was that I'm so glad that they explain the methodology. I could go do this data analysis is my point, right? And you might be right, Felix. I expect you are right because you're right that people, that blacks with higher incomes still have worse credit scores. And ultimately, the APR, the interest rate that they charge, probably has more to do with the credit score than their income, although it probably has to do with both of them. But the point is that I can go do this analysis too. And I think that's pretty cool that they've set it up so that I can go do it.
So now that we've defended Warren Buffett a little bit, I want to go back to criticizing him, which is, you know, it's not just the differential in rates that was a problem. There's all sorts of rot that they were uncovering. One of the big problems was that there's this in-house lender called Vanderbilt. And one of the rules for when you're selling a home is you are not supposed to push a specific lender. You're not allowed to say, oh, come to our in-house lender. But
unless you are specifically licensed to do so, which most of these mobile home salespeople are not.
Yeah, exactly. And so BuzzFeed and Seattle Times talked to, I think, like 280 buyers, people who had purchased homes to this company. And they found was sometimes they were told there were no other lenders making loans.
They even
loans.
Got someone to record their conversation.
Yeah. Exactly. They were told that there were no other lenders in their area, even though that wasn't true. They would do things like they would have basically a billboard in the office. And even though the home salesman could not push Vanderbilt, there'd be a big red button on the billboard. And if you pressed the big red button, there is a recorded pitch for Vanderbilt. And the thing about Vanderbilt was that it gave worse terms. According to their research, it consistently overcharged both poor people and minorities, but they were specifically targeting non-English speakers. And they were doing it through their advertising, through fairly sophisticated geographic analysis to find immigrant communities. And then handing them, like you said, Felix, these stacks of papers that were written in dense English legalese with nobody to translate for them, and thereby giving them these homes that they had basically no chance of being able to pay off. There are all sorts of, I think, interesting issues here also.
I think that the one which I would really like to pick up on is a very simple test, which no responsible lender should ever fail, which is, do you make money on this loan even when it defaults? And if the answer is, yeah, we always make money even when they default, that's a very likely to be a predatory loan.
Well, listen, I mean, nobody makes money if the default is immediate.
That's not true.
No, in this case,
they do.
What?
Yeah. Yes. This is why
I missed that. Tell me how that's
possible. Because this is how it happens. Because they get these... They charge a whole bunch of fees and down payments and stuff up front.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And then... You know what the thing is about mobile homes?
Tell me the thing.
They're mobile.
Oh. You can take them back.
So you give the person the mobile home. They live in it for, you know, a month or two. They default. They don't make any payments. And you just tow it away. And then you sell it to someone else. And you get the, and then you do the same thing. You get all of the fees up front. Give it to someone.
Upfront plus the repo.
It's more similar to predatory car lending in that sense than it is to predatory home lending in that you can just take back a car and sell it as a used car and still make a pretty good profit in the end. And so they don't really worry much if less than a year later they're going to have to be repossessing it.
And by the way, I want to throw in that they also looked into the internal corporate culture at Vanderbilt, and they found some really nasty practices, especially for debt collectors who are just super demeaning.
They recorded someone on the phone saying, well, you could try selling some plasma.
So I have a question, though. One of the big problems with the lead up with the housing bubble and the lead up to the financial crisis was there wasn't really anyone regulating mortgages. You know, we're supposed to have the CFPB now kind of looking at predatory lending and trying to do something about it. But if all this was going on and it was available in the data and no one was doing anything about it until BuzzFeed and the Seattle Times dug into the numbers, which were presumably available to government regulators as well. What does that say about our current state of regulation?
There's a lot of bad lenders out there. But yeah. I mean, I do think that they...
But this is a huge one. I mean, but Clayton
it's a huge
is...
One.
Clayton is... They argue that is the nation's largest home builder.
Okay, so Clayton refused to cooperate with the reporters doing this story and then put out a detailed response after the story came out, and I hate it when companies behave that way, and it's just always a red flag. In this detailed response, they were basically making this case that they are the only people who are providing this incredibly important service to an underserved community. The underserved community is being the, you know, the poor people and the minorities who are the victims of the predatory lending, and the incredibly important service being we will give you a mortgage, basically. And as we have covered on this podcast many times in the past, my general feeling about this is, and we had Howell Pollack on last week saying, only buy a house if you can afford it. This is a prime example of this is a service which no one really should get, because if you can't afford a house, you shouldn't be getting a house. And saying, I've created a way of lending you money so that you can get a house, you're not helping things.
Beyond that, so what is the argument for encouraging mobile home ownership? I mean, it's a depreciating asset. It's not like a mobile home gains value. Maybe the land it's on gains value over time.
No, but it doesn't. You're absolutely right that you don't even get the capital appreciation. The only real argument for buying a house that has ever really swayed me on an economic level is that it is a commitment device which forces you to pay a certain amount of money every month, and at the end of it, you own a valuable asset.
Yeah.
This argument does not apply to mobile homes, because at the end of it, you own a piece of junk which no one wants to buy.
Exactly.
You have to compare it to what the other options these people have, and that's renting. And if they also have, you know, terrible renting costs, then... Look, I'm not defending this industry whatsoever. It's
no,
awful.
But this is the whole point, is that no one is saying, even Clayton Holmes is not saying, that the cost of owning one of these homes is lower than the cost of renting one.
Yeah.
And if you rent them, you have much more flexibility. You can move if you run into money troubles.
It reminds me so much of the for-profit college industry, especially for the marketing, but also for this thing. This is like an American dream thing. You know, you're supposed to go to college. This is American dream. You're supposed to buy a house. And I think that's what one of the selling points of it.
So they're selling like an ersatz house that doesn't actually have all the same economic benefits.
Right.
But
they're acting like it is.
I can imagine maybe some people would justify it to themselves saying, I live in a poor rural part of Mississippi or Alabama full of unscrupulous landlords, and this is my way of getting away from landlords. Like, this is, even if I have to pay a little more, at least I have some independence. But even that, you're then in debt to a predatory lender.
And land is cheap. You know, one of the ways that the economics works is that Clayton loves to talk about how its down payments are high. It has 20% down payments from lots of people. This is only true because it doesn't consider down payments to be cash. It considers down payments to be land. So if you own a plot of land and say, I want to put a mobile home on this plot of land, they will basically take title to that land and consider that to be a down payment, which is just horrible.
They're taking collateral, essentially, calling it a down payment. Yeah.
It is a very common way of structuring these deals, and you can see how attractive it is, because if you own a small plot of land, you can buy a mobile home for $70,000, $80,000. You can get an $80,000 mobile home, which is like 1,400 square feet and big enough for a family. If you wanted to build a 1,400 square foot home, it would cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars. So it's a lot cheaper.
So when does all this start to look bad for Warren Buffett is my question. Do you think he's
untouchable?
You think he's just like, he has such folksy charm that it's just never going to start to erode his reputation?
He's Teflon.
Well, I'm looking for the attorney general offices of the relevant states to take a look at this. I mean, don't you think that the BuzzFeed and Seattle Times has set it up for them pretty well?
It's happening in states, especially where the attorneys general tend not to be as quite as aggressive.
Especially it's happening in states where there's a lot of predatory lenders who get away with it. Lending is considered to be, you know, a bit like gun ownership. It's a sort of carpe diem thing.
Well, I guess I think that this article is going to at least embarrass the attorney general office. I mean, even if it doesn't embarrass Warren Buffett.
Oh, the racial element. Kathy, you poor, naive, deluded soul.
The racial element makes it more likely, I think, because
bad shit.
We are in this country where we crack down much harder on people who screw minorities than people who just screw poor people, or we're supposed to. That's how laws are sort of built. So maybe.
We'll
see. Okay, next up. The numbers round. But first, another sponsor, which is MileIQ, which is this little app you download for your phone, and it automatically works out where you're driving and because it can tell when you're in a car and you're driving. And then you get a list of all the car trips that you've taken. And then you can sort of swipe left and swipe right. And you can register which of those car trips are work-related, are business-related, in which you're allowed to get money back. And most people don't bother with this because it's a pain in the ass listing trips. But with the app, MileIQ, you can make $500 a month just by sort of pressing a button and registering your trips and getting the money that you're owed. So if you drive a car for work, MileIQ is a bit of a no-brainer. So what you do is you text Slate Money to 31996 and you get a 40-drive free trial. 40 drive. So if it takes you 3 months to make 40 drives, then it will be a free trial lasting for 40 drives.
Sorry to
drives.
Interrupt.
No, feel free. Jump right in. And what's more, you get not only to try this out for 40 drives and see how easy it is, you also get 20% off the annual plan, which you are sure to sign up for because the average MileIQ user logs $547 a month. In drives. That's over $6,000 a year in miles that you could be claiming. So go for it. 31996. Text Slate Money to 31996. Before we move on to the numbers round, we're going to move on to the corrections and clarifications round, which Zach Dinerstein has been doing some real-time correcting and clarifying
in his
little glass box. Zach, what are you going to tell us about Flavortown?
Thank you, Felix. So Guy Fieri's American Kitchen is holding a New Year's Eve party, and it has a five-hour open bar. 5 hour.
And how much does that cost?
It costs $120 for general admission, and couple VIP package is $700. Still cheaper than Bubba Gump Shrimp.
$120.
I could drink $120.
5 hour open bar. I can. Yeah,
it's easy.
Although if I remember the Pete
it's
Wells,
like two drinks,
the drinks
in
are
New
supposed
York.
To be terrible. That's...
But wait, let's correct and clarify your correction and your clarification here. Is Guy Fieri's American Kitchen same restaurant?
It is.
And the same name as the one that.
Yes, that is. That's the Pete Wells
review.
Yes, it is. I'm telling you right now. I love that review.
It's a great review, but I didn't think it was called American Kitchen.
Yeah, he can't actually call it Flavortown. I think there's like a sign that probably says Welcome to Flavortown. But
so now that I've completely lost my appetite, Kathy, what's your number?
My number is 511, which is the number between 253 and 770. I found this incredible statistic about additional rapes that happen on football weekends.
Oh, boy.
Jordan looks skeptical.
What's a football weekend?
College football weekend.
Out of the 128 schools that participate in Division 1A football, they think that overall, per year, you have about 511 additional rapes because the rate of rapes goes up on weekends that are football games.
If we needed another reason to ban college football, this is a good one.
I am really anti-football at this point. I used to be a football fan, and I've just like...
You still listen to a lot of sports radio.
I listen to sports radio, but I've boycotted football this season because I've just done with it. It's like, it's too bad. And of course, I just want to say, to be fair... This is about parties. This is not really about the football game. This is about the parties associated with football games.
But still, like, if you get rid of the football game, you get thousands of women around the country who will not be raped as a result.
That's right. Well,
okay,
hundreds.
Let's do it.
Assuming the amount of drinking goes down. The look I gave you wasn't skepticism. It was just I remember looking at this article when it came out on National Bureau of Economic Research and going, oh, God, this is depressing.
It is. It's really sad.
But, yeah, there are all sorts of issues with college partying and sexual assault, and this just sort of highlights them. I think this effect is probably the same for basketball games at places that have major teams there, too. It just this happened to look at football. I'm guessing. That's my assumption. Any major big-time college sport is probably going to produce where people are drinking. It's going to produce this problem.
I use my litmus test of like whether I'd want my kids to do it, and the answer is
rape.
Well, no, come
I think
on,
football
Felix.
Is where
football playing football or going to those kinds of parties. I would say no.
Okay.
So my number is actually, as Felix said to me earlier, I'm making it up, but it's a prediction. I thought about writing an article about this, but it's easier to say it on the air. I just want to go on the record and say I don't think the Federal Reserve is going to raise short-term interest rates above 1%. I want to put that as a benchmark. Basically, the Fed is going to fail in its ambitions this year, because, and partly
in 2016.
In 2016. And my feeling about that is partly because, A, none of the major problems, with the exception of maybe the Greek crisis, have really been solved from the past year in the world economy. Beyond that, oil has continued to slide, and that's going to have a hangover effect for the next year that's probably going to keep us close to deflation, or could potentially keep us close to deflation, especially if the price of the dollar rises, which for a lot of reasons I think it
will. So your prediction is that interest rates at this time next year are going to be no higher than 1%.
Yes, there will be short-term interest rates. The Fed target rate will be no more than 1%.
I'm actually going to say 0.75.
You think it's going to be one? So basically you're saying...
Of course, if you're Narayana Kochilakoti, you think it's going to be negative.
So. Well, he in his heart of hearts, he wants it to be negative. But yeah, so that's I just want to go on the record saying
that. Yeah, I'm going to agree.
You're actually going one lower than
I'm going lower.
Okay.
My number is... I'm doing some mental arithmetic here. My number is $207.5 billion.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. That's actually a sum. That's the sum of $104 billion, which Apple has spent on buybacks over the past 3 years, plus $143.5 billion that Apple has spent on dividends over the past 3 years. So you add those two together, and what you get is $207.5 billion, which is the amount of money, sorry, $247.5 billion, which Apple has returned to shareholders just in the past 3 years alone. And you know what's amazing? Is that over the course of those 3 years, the amount of cash on Apple's balance sheet has gone up.
Mm. So here's people bemoan
they
stock
can't give away their money fast enough.
So,
sorry.
Yeah, people bemoan stock buybacks for all sorts of reasons. There's a part of the kind of left that is convinced that they're actually hurting growth by making companies not invest more. But I think Apple is, if anything, a good example of how that's not necessarily always the case, because they are trying to come up with things to spend it on. They invented a watch, for instance, that doesn't seem to be doing too well. They're considering maybe getting into cars. They really don't seem to know what to do with their money. And so I don't know that giving it back to shareholders is necessarily the wrong thing in this case.
I mean, like, I have an Android phone, right?
Yeah.
I didn't get an iPhone. But what is the Android equivalent for a laptop? Like, you know,
yeah.
There isn't anything. Like, what do I buy?
There are Chromebooks.
Okay. Maybe I'll buy a Chromebook instead of a MacBook next time.
There you go.
But so, because
I'm just saying, there's the competition for laptops is pretty weak.
Yeah, competition. But I mean, in the end, they just have the iPhone just is basically a license to print money for them, and they don't know how to reinvest that money.
And for the record, you know, even though if you walk into a coffee shop in Manhattan, all you see is MacBooks, laptops are still overwhelmingly Windows or Chrome OS.
Yeah.
They're not, you know, Mac OS is still a very small minority of computers. So
really?
It's a coastal elite thing, yeah. It's a coastal snob thing. No, but
I guess I am a snob.
But yeah, so I don't really worry about the buybacks with Apple. Because I don't know what the hell else they would do with it, except for literally just leave it sitting in overseas accounts.
Yeah, which they do too.
Yeah, which they are still doing, yeah.
Okay, so that is it for us this week. Thank you for listening to Slate Money. Many thanks to Kathy O'Neill, to Jordan Weissman, to Zach Dinerstein, to Andy Bowers, who executive produces this entire Panoply network, which is all to be found at itunes.com/panoply. Happy New Year to all of you.
Happy New Year.
We're thinking of New Year's resolution,
yes,
sort of fitness episode next week. If you have any questions.
It's all a scam, people.
In those, along
but
those lines.
I buy that scam so hard. I buy it.
We love that scam.
The email address, if you want to give Jordan some unsolicited advice on weight training, is slatemoney@slate.com.
Yeah, next week we're going to talk about Jordan's attempts to get swole. It's going to be great.
Jordan is going to be beefed up. So Jordan, what's going to happen to your you know, if we're making numerical predictions here, what's going to happen to your like muscle mass over 2016?
Okay, I'm going to go with a realistic prediction, which is absolutely jack. But I'm going to try to prove myself wrong. So
all right. Do you have any New Year's resolutions you want to discuss, Felix?
So my New Year's resolution is a really boring one, but I'm going to write about changing the world and philanthropy and things like that more in 2016.
Okay. That wasn't the one I was hoping for.
So, what was the one you were hoping
for?
I'm
going to get swole. You're going to write about changing the world and what are you going
to... Well, no, I don't actually want to know what Kathy's New Year's resolution is. I want to know what is the New Year's resolution that Kathy was hoping for?
About interrupting Jordan.
Oh.
Yeah,
yes,
let's discuss this.
So, that one. So there is this other thing that there's this constant back channel of emails to SlateMoney@slate.com.
We love you.
Saying, we love you, Felix, but will you stop interrupting Jordan and or Kathy?
Especially Jordan, but yes, both.
And so I tried to interrupt as much as I could this week because because you know, I can only get better from that, right?
You know, he's getting it out of his system.
That did not amount to a resolution.
No, I think what Felix meant to say was he was getting it out of his system before going cold turkey in 2016.
Let me interrupt you, Jordan, to mention that Felix did not say that.
All right.
We may or may not see less interruption, depending partly on whether we can get clocks installed in the State Studios. We are moving, by the way.
We are?
I don't know if you know this, Kathy, but we are moving to Brooklyn.
Yep, Slate's moving to Brooklyn next
in
year.
In March. Yeah.
That's no good for my commute.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's straight there on the 2-3.
You can also get there on the A train. So.
Okay.
So we are going to have state-of-the-art new podcasting studios in
Amazing.
Brooklyn. And maybe they will have clocks on the walls.
Wow.
You know, anything is possible. All right, we'll talk to you next week on Slate Money.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.